Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you today as summer in Vancouver all too quickly wraps up. We're heading into fall and looking forward to the future issues of the journal. And today I have the opportunity to speak with Amelia Kehoe, who is a very nearly completed PhD candidate at Durham University in the UK. I understand, Amelia, that you have only 2 months to go.
Yeah, very close to finishing.
Very close, outstanding. It's an exciting time for you, no doubt.
Yeah.
Amelia also mentioned just before getting on this call that she's just returned very recently from a conference, so I really do feel like I'm taking advantage of her time by having her squeeze this in, but I appreciate you doing this.
No, it's great. I've had lots of opportunities to discuss, so I'm ready to keep discussing it. It's fine.
Excellent. Well, you know, but our listeners won't yet, that we're going to talk about a paper that you have coming out in the October 2016 issue of Medical Education. And the title is Supporting International Medical Graduates Transition to Their Host Country, Realist Synthesis. Mm-hmm. This is obviously a focus of a broad area of study for you, given that it's part of your PhD work. Can I maybe start by asking about the title and the assumption that's implicit in it, that we need to support international medical graduates' transition? Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the literature says in this regard and why it's an important issue?
Yeah, the focus originally was on the UK, purely because it's funded by a trust here who have tried to develop an intervention in response to those from overseas, the more overrepresented in the fitness to practice. They're kind of five times more likely to be struck off, which sounds quite negative. But actually, my view is that if you've got this information, then why not try to support them, you know, rather than if you're seeing them fail, it might not necessarily be competent. So my view is to look at that initially, because 41.5% of doctors in the UK are from overseas. And I know it's a problem in terms of supporting them and how to do that in other countries. So, for example, Canada and Australia and New Zealand seem to be key countries that are really wanting to overcome those sort of issues. So things like communication, teamwork, different culture, different practice, ethics, and all those things, which I think they can be resolved because they are a group of doctors that add great value to practice, and we need them, especially, obviously, from my experience in the UK, we really depend on them. So I think it's better to try and support them in that transition. I really wanted to help develop something, but actually know whether it worked or not, rather than, you know, sometimes interventions can be kind of like a ticky box. We do it because we know we need to, but we're not sure whether it works.
Yeah, and just before we get into any ways in which one might intervene, let me ask you to elaborate a little bit. You started to mention communication issues and teamwork and highlighted attention, I think, in your comments.
Yeah.
In that there are many countries that are very dependent on people coming in from other areas, and it seems to me, at least in my perception, that it's not necessarily that there are particular countries putting out physicians that are substandard by other countries' metrics, but physicians going both directions often struggle with that transition. And what are the types of issues that seem to show up most prominently that have provided some guidance for you around how to start supporting these individuals?
One of the key things that was coming out was obviously communication, but not just language. It was, you know, having the confidence to ask questions. So in a lot of international countries, the consultant is seen as, you know, sometimes more godlike, and the junior doctors won't want to ask questions, so they get on with things through fear of being seen as incompetent. So when they were transitioning to the new countries, they weren't having that confidence to speak up, and then that's when the performance issues were coming about. That was one of the main things, just the difference in culture. Not necessarily that they don't know. They're not always aware of the different practice. So things like, as well, nurses. I spoke to a lot of graduates here who they got told off a lot and complained about because they were treating the nurses in not a very nice way. But in their country, they used the term, they were kind of the dog's body. We just used them to do the paperwork and things. Whereas obviously here, everything's more level. So it's just the fact they weren't aware.
Right, and you've just highlighted a number of, you know, challenges that would arise from cultural norms being different. That suggests quite clearly that people coming from different parts of the world might have different clashes, so to speak, between cultures, and even within any given culture. We should probably say early on in this conversation that there are going to be vast differences in individuals and how readily they're able to adapt to these things. What made you hope that there was some general strategy that might be developed for intervening across all that variability that is present?
Well, from my early work of kind of scoping the literature and talking to overseas graduates here in the UK, it came across that it was more the lack of initial information and the lack of support that was then hindering their progress. So obviously people are coming with different needs, like you say, and they're all coming at different levels, and some are coming to training posts, some are coming to more senior posts. But I saw the need that they have these safety nets. So if they're feeling like they need to ask a question, or if they're not understanding, or even supervisors, I think, should pick that up, but that seems to be lacking. A lot of the literature, you know, when they were given the intervention and then when they went back into practice, that ongoing support lost. And I just thought that, I know everyone will have different needs and it can't always be addressed, you know, with one simple intervention, but I saw that you can kind of have guidelines to put in place to then make sure that they've got those different levels of support, both initially and ongoing.
Right, okay. And you've alluded a couple of times now to going to the literature and trying to find guidance for how to develop such guidelines. Realist syntheses are becoming increasingly popular, I think, but I'm sure there's a lot of our listeners who won't know what it means to conduct a realist synthesis. Do you mind explaining a little bit what that is and why you thought that was an appropriate approach for this topic?
Yeah, so I came across it because when I was looking at the literature initially, actually there was a paper as well in Medical Education not long ago by Limebury et al. They did a systematic review, I think, of educational interventions for international medical graduates. And they had said, you know, there's a lack of theory and lack of outcome. And I found that also, because the focus is often on just those outcomes rather than explaining, you know, why something works and how something works. So in terms of the practical application of interventions and people who read the findings, they're not going to know how to do it. They're only going to know that it works. Mm-hmm. And then again, you don't know what aspect of the intervention works, because overseas graduates and their transition, it's complex. And as the paper shows, there's so many different interventions that you can use. You know, you can have the buddying and you can have just a one-day induction. And I think it's impossible to understand what works just by outcomes, especially if you have one intervention that you can't really do pre and post, because you don't know which elements are necessarily working. So I looked into the realist approach and I saw it kind of gives that greater explanatory power of explaining why the interventions work. And so it's kind of filling that gap where obviously the literature shows that the theory is missing. And it's very much a focus on context and how that influences the intervention. So for those that don't know, you have obviously context, mechanism and outcome configurations that you kind of develop. So as an example, context could be, you know, the support I was talking about. And then that could be to, you know, increase confidence, which could be the mechanism. And then obviously they have more confidence to ask questions and willing to ask for that support, which then obviously would impact on the outcome of their performance and patient safety. And so the aim of the realist is kind of develop this program theory, which then explains how the intervention is working. And I just thought that was really crucial in terms of, you know, the complexity of looking at overseas graduate transition. As well, like you said, there's so many interventions and lots of different factors to consider. So I thought it's better to have a theory that you can maybe apply and develop and change to suit whatever intervention people are looking to develop.
Yeah, and I think your findings do support that notion that it is a complex issue and there are going to be a number of contextual and individual factors to consider. We won't be able to go into all the details, but that mechanism that you're just alluding to, or the theory that you've been trying to develop through this effort at synthesis, what would you say are the key features of that that you think others who are trying to support IMGs should pay attention to?
Yeah, so there were so many factors that came out, which obviously is a great thing of the realist synthesis, but then also it's hard to know when to stop, because I just kept reading things, and so that's why it's a vast model, because I wanted to include everything that I thought was really important. But yeah, the main things, I guess, is obviously I've got the three levels, the individual level, which is obviously the individual needs and where they've come from and their role identity, and the training level, obviously the intervention would be within that, but kind of the content and the design of it, but that, I guess, is the ongoing support, which I think is key, rather than just, like I said before, giving them an intervention and then maybe a one-day induction and then letting them carry on. So definitely the ongoing support, I think, comes out a lot in that from both supervisors and peers. And another thing is at the organisational level is how to pick up the overseas graduates and identify who they are when they're starting in the trust. Because I spoke to a lot of trusts where I'm trying to, you know, discuss what they do and how they identify those that may be struggling and what they do to overcome the issues. And sometimes they don't know who the overseas graduates are. I think that's quite an issue in itself because you don't want to discriminate them. But I think it's important that if we're identifying that it's quite an issue, to have that support there. You need to identify who they are for you to place that safety net. So I think that is an issue because organisations, they don't want to be seen as being discriminatory towards them. And another thing to do with that and kind of identifying them was that kind of HR, they aren't always aware of who's working. Because obviously overseas graduates, they come in lots of routes. So you can obviously have those that are training, you have those in non-training posts, you might have locum doctors. And so they're all through different streams into the organisation. Monitoring them seems to be very difficult. So when I was interviewing people for the next part of my project that I haven't spoken about in the paper, but sometimes I would ask, can I have their information? Because they've agreed to do an interview and they'll say, oh, they're not working in the trust. I'm sure they are. I've just spoken to them and they're in the scrubs and they've just been operating on someone. So I know that they're working in your trust. And so actually the staff list, they didn't even know who was there. So I think that's quite important in terms of not just for the intervention, but monitoring staff. And the final thing, I guess, is kind of the organisation level and how to implement the interventions is, I think they work better more at a local level and rather than the big regional interventions. So, for example, the intervention that I'm focusing on in evaluating, which is one of the case studies, they had that support at the local level in all different ways. They had lots of safety nets. And so the individuals, they perform better and they had higher retention and they progressed in their career because that organisation was putting all of that support in place. Whereas others that had attended one-day regional events, when they went back to the local trusts, they weren't getting that support. And I think the impact of the intervention were lost because it wasn't at the local level and it wasn't ongoing. I've rambled on, but they're the three key things.
No, that didn't feel rambling at all. As I alluded to, it will require our listeners to go and get the details out of the paper because we won't have time to cover it all. But if I could ask you just one more thing in terms of those recommendations that you've just laid out in terms of where to focus on designing the intervention, did your theory that you developed or the effort you made at the synthesis lead you to any insights with respect to what people should be paying attention to monitor the success or the need to adjust their interventions as they're developing them?
I think that pre and post questionnaires don't necessarily work for this purely because it's not a long-term assessment, I don't feel, because the transition is very different for different individuals. The way that I have chosen to look at it, and it worked, is to look at retention and performance. And I looked at performance data on the systems within the local trusts, and that looks at things like serious and untoward incidents and complaints. And what I did was I looked at the whole system, not just overseas graduates. And obviously the literature would suggest that overseas graduates are represented much higher. So when I looked at that, the intervention group, they were no different, and if not less, on the educational data system. And so I think it needs to be more long-term rather than, you know, the pre and post questionnaires, which in the literature, that's what most of the intervention evaluation was. A lot of it was kind of satisfaction scales, which I think, great to know that they like them, but I just don't think it's robust enough to know whether an intervention works or not. So yeah, monitoring long-term in terms of career progression and retention, I guess, would be the most important thing.
Right. Okay. Thank you again for sharing these insights with us and for time to chat. I'll just close by reminding our listeners that I've been speaking with Amelia Kehoe, and we've been talking about a paper entitled Supporting International Medical Graduates Transition to Their Host Country, A Real Synthesis, that you'll find in the October 2016 issue of Medical Education. Amelia, congratulations again on being so close to the completion of your PhD. By the time people listen to this, they'll probably be very close to defending. It's an impressive body of work, though, and I wish you the best of luck with your final stages.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.